Welcome to Educa K-16 podcast. I am Sandra Gonzalez, and my co-hosts today are Dr. Abdin Novoa and Dr. Tony Baez. With us today, we have a special guest, Angela Valenzuela. Welcome, Dr. Novoa and Dr. Baez. And to our listeners in the North, South, East, and West, stay tuned for a very special education episode. Thank you. Shout out to DTO Music, to Jose Carlos from Vodels Post Production, and to Arte de Zone for our logo. For more info, remember to go to domasgroup.com and find other podcasts there.
Thank you, Sandra. It's great to be back once again. Thank you, Sandra, for the introduction. And different from what we have done in the past, we have as a co-host, Tony Baez. And Tony has been with us in the past on a former podcast. And so, Tony, if you can hear me, Tony's in Milwaukee. I'm in San Juan, and our guest is in Austin, Texas. Tony, if you can hear me well, say hi.
Welcome. Hello, hello.
Good to have you, Tony. And we're doing this for the first time with me co-hosting with Tony, so it's a pleasure to have him. We also have with us a very, very special guest, a friend of both Tony and myself. And it's a pleasure for us to have her here. And so welcome, Angela, la doctora. Dr. Angela Valenzuela from Austin, Texas. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you, even though by remote and virtual. And so in continuation of our podcast series, as you know, we have different guests talking about different issues on Latinos in education. And today we're going to hit a whole new topic that we have not fully touched on in terms of Latinos in education. And without giving you a topic heading, we'll let the process roll out some of these issues. And so to present Angela and introduce her briefly to our audience, I will turn it to Tony Baez to do the introduction.
Thank you, Dr. Novoa. And welcome, Dr. Valenzuela. We've known Dean and Dr. Valenzuela, and I have known each other for a very long time. We've been in some of the same battles. We've been trying to do national movements and all of that. And I particularly have always been very impressed by the fact that Dr. Valenzuela has been at the very center of getting us together in Austin, Texas, and in other parts of the country. Dr. Valenzuela is a pretty well-known figure in the educational circles in the Southwest, having been involved in testimony in ethnic studies, having been an author of significance, an author of great weight. Every time I look at the scholarly work of some of our Latinos, they always quote Dr. Angela Valenzuela. So when you start being quoted, it's because you're somebody and you're doing something significant. I am also impressed by the fact that at the local level in Austin, she has been very involved in community issues and issues related to Latinos and education, but not only that, in issues that are sort of like part of that intersectionality that we all have to be a part of, particularly with gender issues and what's happening right now in Texas with women and what's happening with Latinos in their fight for ethnic studies and the community battles for bilingual education. All of those things have been part of the repertoire and the work of Dr. Angela Valenzuela. And then there is NELRAP. NELRAP is the National Latino Educational Research and Policy Organization that brings together a number of scholars and progressive deans and the issues related to how do we improve, grow your own for the preparation of future bilingual educators and Latino educators. And NERAP has been at the center of all of that. I know NERAP pretty well because I'm a former chair of NERAP, but Angela has been doing a fantastic work of that solidarity and that connection of people with NERAP all the way from New York and Florida to California and Texas and New Mexico. And that speaks highly of somebody like Dr. Angela Valenzuela. So welcome to our program. And you can add what else you think is important for our audience to know about you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And gosh, I'm just in awe of both of you and your own work and your commitments over the years. And so the feeling is truly mutual. Muchísimas gracias. Les agradezco mucho. I mean, you're leaders. You're people that I have admired very much over the years for your own advocacy and the fights and struggles that you've been involved in and that we've taken on collectively. So thank you so much.
Great to have you, Angela. And I will begin the questioning. Basically, it's a dialogue. Tony and I will kind of hand it off back and forth in terms of getting to know a little bit more about what you have done and the significance of that kind of work. And so let me begin. In terms of ethnic studies, we can call it Latino studies, Chicano studies, Puerto Rican studies, but by whatever category of name that we use, the question comes in now more than ever because of some of the national dialogue that's taking place. What do we mean by that? Why is it necessary? Is it important? And what does it have to do with education? And so to begin with, can you put it into perspective for us? Because there's a lot of questions as to not only what it is, but why should it be? So let's begin there and then we'll build on that. Angela, how would you respond?
Yes, thank you. I think it's important to first define ethnic studies so that people know what we mean when we say ethnic studies. It's a large umbrella of research-based content. It consists of pedagogies that relate to what we in the ethnic studies community seek. That is content and pedagogies, research that contributes to our values, but also to just larger issues related to our healing and our empowerment, our well-being. Ethnic studies historically has consisted of Mexican American studies, African American studies, Native American studies, Asian American studies. I mean, there's even, you know, of course, Arab American and Southwest Asian studies. There's Puerto Rican studies, Boricua studies, and I think in time we'll be seeing other groups like Salvadorian studies that will mature in the context of an increasingly diverse America. And so, ethnic studies can be understood in the classroom as roughly aligning to one of three approaches. And so one might be where you infuse, it's an infusion approach, where you infuse social studies or ethnic studies content into a class like social studies so that you really have a merging of maybe Mexican American studies and social studies or any other group or groups within the context of a social studies classroom. This has been done, and it has been done well. Another would be a comparative thematic approach where you're addressing the major groups, perhaps the ones that are particularly represented in your school district or in your state that would align roughly perhaps to the Heritage Month. So right now, you know, we're in Hispanic Heritage Month, and so I know AISD aligns the Austin Independent School District where we have where we are situated, they have aligned ethnic studies with this month with during this time period with Mexican Americans and Latino or Latinx histories, cultures, identities, and the like. The third approach is what aligns to what we do at the university, and we have to understand that ethnic studies, as we know it today, began in the late 60s and early 70s in the universities. And so what we know today as ethnic studies is still this umbrella, this umbrella category, but which is the home to what we might call single group studies. That is, for example, at UT, we have Mexican American studies, Native American and Indigenous studies. We have African American studies. And women and gender studies can also be a part of that. I am biased toward the single group studies, I have to tell you, because there's just been so much knowledge production over the past 50 years in each of these areas. And it's knowledge production with respect to, history, politics, political culture, demographics, population studies. And so there's a lot that has been researched. And so one can really go in depth into one of the single group approaches, which, we might think of as field-based or disciplinary approaches. Within that, probably across the groups, there would be overlap, but the content would vary because of the unique group's experiences. And so we're talking about within the teaching of it, and this is what NLRAP advocates, is a focus on the socio-political aspects of history, looking at court cases, looking at policies, looking at political dynamics and formations and how these carry out in the experiences of, say, Mexican Americans or Puerto Ricans. Social cultural perspectives are also important.
A key question that keeps coming up that we're hearing from listeners is, why should we have courses like this? And if we have courses like this, does it detract from other courses where there is competition in terms of time, in terms of emphasis? Why should we take time to talk about something that relates to particular groups in this country today, when we know what's going on in the guise of diversity, or within the talent pool of the country? The criticism is like what's happening right now with critical race theory dialogue, that we don't need that. Why should we have it? We already have U.S. history. So why the emphasis? And again, the question is, okay, so what is it that we're missing in that kind of understanding?
What we're missing is imagination, because the curriculum that exists was created by people, right? It didn't come a priori or without a context and without real people sitting around a table and saying, this is what we're going to offer our students in K-12 public schools. So first of all, we have to just kind of, relax the assumption that the curriculum that we have in place is all that we need, as if history and as if content and as if things don't evolve, when we know that they do. And also, I think it's a false it's a false presupposition that to have ethnic studies is in competition with the existing curriculum, because, as I mentioned, there are infusion approaches. Ideally, every course would be infused with these critical perspectives. I know Oregon, the state of Oregon, has worked on going in that direction of infusing every single course with critical social-cultural, social-political perspectives. I mean, that would be the alternative. Ideally, we wouldn't even need, at the higher education, Mexican-American studies, Native American studies, et cetera, because our stories, our histories, our cultures, our experiences would be part of the curriculum, but because they are not and they're structured out systemically, that's what gave rise to the need for ethnic studies to begin with. And I mean, I think, separate from that, what critical race theory offers is a research approach, and it's a pedagogy. People are calling it a curriculum. It's not a curriculum. I mean, I teach it, and it's more of a pedagogy and a research approach, and it's really about understanding the trauma that we have been subjected to in this country as peoples of color, that have been subjected to overt and covert forms of discrimination, forces of exclusion. All you have to do is look at the front page today in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the entirety of this week to see that there is a major attack on people of color in Texas. There's a major attack on women, right, and poor people. And that's layered over what is a long history of a real disrespect for our cultures, our languages, our dialects, and our identities. When all of these things are in jail, your language is in jail, your culture is in jail, who you are, your identity is in jail. Well, I mean, you're basically in jail, right? You're basically invisible and invisibilized by a system that wants to keep it that way, lest you become a Tony Baez, lest you become an Angela Valenzuela or an Abdino Novoa Rios, right? I mean, that's what they're trying to keep from happening, right? And so this is an important struggle as we move from margins to center, not only theoretically, but also demographically. And for us to be part of that shift and guide that shift in a way that embraces the complexity of lived experience, and not just having to do with race, but the other intersectional aspects of our identities related to gender, sexuality, our language, our accents, and so on. This is ultimately for everybody's good. It's the good medicine, right, that is being demonized because of people in power not wanting to conceive it.
Angela, that's very good. I think that you have hit on the nail a lot of the concerns that many have about this issue of ethnic studies. I mean, if anybody thinks out there, the critics that Dr. Novoa mentioned, that the curriculum is static, they are very foolish. They have no idea how curriculum works and how it has evolved throughout the years. But I think that what's happening is that people like us know that curriculum is not static and that it has evolved on behalf of the interests of people in power, and particularly where power is exerted, like what happens in Texas right now with, you win the election and then you think you can do everything, in spite of the fact that Texas is becoming more and more Latinos all the time. So I see that, but you have done something very interesting in your personal work with this intersectionality and realizing that it's not just what happens in the academia and the universities, but that what happens in communities is critical. I mean, many of us would have never done degrees and wouldn't be called doctors today if communities of color and Black communities, Latino communities, had not risen and had fought public education and what they did and the role of parents and the role of community. And in Austin, you have dealt with Academia Cuautli, and I was super impressed with some of the parents I met when I went to Austin and participated and spoke there and interacted with folks that were involved in Academia Cuautli. It's sort of like it shouldn't be an add-on that's done during weekends and all that. It should be integrated in everything that happens in schools. And I'm glad that some districts are moving in that direction. But you still do some amazing things with community, with Latino parents, with immigrant parents that are so essential to what's happening in the fight for education, the fight for bilingual education, the fight for more community control of these schools through Academia Cuautli. Could you tell us a little bit more about Academia Cuautli?
Thank you, Tony. One of my most favorite topics. And so what you must know, what everybody must know, is that the whole idea of Academia Quietly really came from our work at the national level with NLRAP. And we were able to get funding from the Ford and Kellogg Foundations to implement what we envision, which is community-anchored, partnership-based social justice education that creates pathways into the teaching profession. And we talk about it in terms of promoting consciousness, right? And so it's in part creating actual pathways into the teaching profession, because we have a crisis in teacher recruitment and teacher retention. And so we need to be more intentional about that, as you know, Tony, in our school districts, nationwide. And not only bilingual teachers, although yes, bilingual education teachers, but teachers throughout the entire curriculum. We need STEM teachers, right? We need teachers who are bilingual and culturally competent in all of these different areas. And then we need to hold on to them once we bring them into our school system. But Academia Quietly, it means eagle. And so we like the idea of the eagle because it's a symbol of revitalization. It's a symbol of resurrection. It's revered, right? And it's the cousin to the condor in South America. And the eagle also represents to us, the eagle's eye, the bird's eye view. It's just a powerful metaphor for cultivating a generation of teachers and children and families and communities that have an analysis of really what I've just talked about, the political, cultural, historical processes that are at play in our everyday lives that are subordinating us, so that then we can be strategic. And we, with the eagle's eye, it catches its prey, right? It's phenomenal that from the highest peaks it can stoop down and catch its prey with laser-like precision. And so it really is, it's a Nahuatl term, Quautli, and it really is a metaphor for what we think needs to go forward. And the beauty of community-based education is that you make what you want, right? You create your own sense of the future based on real situated grassroots conversations of what we want to have to manifest in our own context. We were founded in 2014, and I'm happy to say that this is our 8th year of operation, and we're a partnership with the Austin Independent School District and the City of Austin. We serve, on the one hand, children in AISD from 6 schools. Right now it's remote because of COVID. They're in the 4th and 5th grade, and we offer them a co-constructed curriculum that we come together, and through the partnership with the district, the teachers actually get resources to develop the curriculum. The partnership pays for the teachers then to administer the curriculum on Saturdays throughout the school year. We're beginning this year on September 11th. And so the focus right now, and it would shift from year to year because you have to, a good curriculum is actually one that evolves with the context. And given the attack, and it's really been pretty ongoing on our community, against the immigrant community, it's been ongoing, right? There's nothing new, but we do have a curriculum this year that will focus on very strongly on identities, multiple identities that we have. We're not just members of racial groups, right? We're members of cultural groups. We're also, intersectional, and so we bring many identities to the schooling context. And the idea is to have teachers and children explore their own strengths and their own possibilities, right? As a consequence of that. Then we're, you know, going to be focusing on migration. Migration is an important identity in the next unit. We migrate, and we've used the image of the butterfly, sin fronteras, right? The butterfly, there's no border for the natural world, and our ancestors have migrated the continent, have a long history. The longest part of our history is one of migration, rather than what we envision today as having this fixed kind of location. Even as we identify strongly with our location and where we are situated in Greater Coahuila, right? In not this imaginary that begins in 1848 here in Texas, with 1848 to the present being the shortest part of our history, but this hemispheric view of who we are as people from this continent that have migrated freely on this continent for millennia. And then the last identity that we'll focus, that is its own unit, the teachers developed it in the summer, is on social activism and an activist identity. And so we look at people that have been, we're looking at this through children's book, that have been advocates in our communities, like Willy Velasquez, and the importance of his work in getting us to become voters, right? An important time period in civil rights in our history. And then the early civil rights history is taught with Emma Tenayuca, and how she was a union leader at a very young age, and who just knew that from her father and her growing up, that it was her responsibility, that whenever she saw an injustice, her responsibility was to actually respond to it, to be responsive to it. And that's a beautiful part of our curriculum, because the students really, they embrace it, and it cultivates their own voice, right? Because they see injustices, and it helps them to envision ways that they, as children, they, as people in their schools, can be responsive to it. The last thing I'll say is that the teachers, in the teaching of the curriculum, and we partner veteran with novice teachers every year, they then implement it in their school contexts district-wide. And we've prepared over, in 8 years, over 250 teachers in this curriculum. And so we do believe that we're having an impact on what gets taught at the ground level, primarily in our dual language programs. It is available to every single teacher district-wide, but we've discovered that it's hard for teachers to just take something off the shelf. And even when they have, they still need to be exposed to it in a meaningful, authentic context. And once they can see it implemented and feel it tangibly, then they can actually make it actionable in their own classroom.
And thank you. That I love what you're saying in terms of identity, in terms of what it means to the student, in terms of even motivation to further pursue more knowledge in that regard. Everybody wants to know who they are, why they are. I want to let our viewers know that they can comment on what we're saying, and through we collect these comments and get back, so that if any of you have questions or would like to get in touch with Angela Valenzuela in terms of what she's talking about, we'd be happy to orient you and guide you and follow up with you in terms of any questions or information that you may have. So I wanted to make that clarification for all of our listeners right now. And I know time is always of the essence, but I wanted to go back to some of the pushback that's been occurring in this country in terms of ethnic studies. And there have been not only good case studies, but also legal challenges to what's taking place. And so I wanted our viewers to get a sense of what some of this has been recently. And I remember a key court case not long ago in Tucson, Arizona, where it was questioned whether Mexican-American studies should even be in the curriculum. Can you tell us a little bit about those struggles that most people do not hear about at the rest of the country?
Yes, absolutely. So ethnic studies, as I've defined it already this morning, is that it's a battleground now, and it has been a battleground. We've seen different manifestations of the culture wars, and this is the latest one, and it is particularly vicious, and I'm confident it has to do with those in power wanting to maintain their incumbencies and not wanting to have critically conscious educators or critically conscious students, lest they lose their incumbencies, lest they lose their power, which is itself a problem, right? Because it's such a narrow vision of the future. There's no high-sounding rhetoric here. There's no plan to really govern. There's nothing to inspire or motivate us to be part of an inclusive civic world. No redemptive vision for the future. Just defensive and divisive politics. If you really want to find out where all of this emanates from, it comes from. Again, it's been happening for some time, but more recently it's gotten focused as a result of Christopher Rufo, who got the ear of Donald Trump. And y'all might remember that Trump eliminated the diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in government toward the end of his term in office. And so this is precisely about picking a fight. And what they're saying is that disingenuously and incorrectly, untruthfully, what they're saying, those on the right and those who are picking this fight, is that we're the ones that are picking the fight, right? And so they're wanting to turn things on its head, but what is truly manifest is a defensive posture. And the reason that they have this defensive posture is white supremacy. White supremacy has this a very long history of establishing what I term in my own writings the colonial matrix of power, frankly, of which the social studies curriculum has been a part. So it's kind of ironic that what has been under attack is, in Texas anyway, is the social studies curriculum, because the social studies curriculum comes into the existence with the American Indian boarding school experience. It's part of the colonial framework and model, and now is very much under attack. And I do support the social studies community and have been, but I think we also need to see and understand these deeper truths that an ethnic studies education reveals, that it exposes, right? And so what we see happening too is just sort of this recoiling, again, a defensive posture, recoiling from the racial justice movement that exploded in the wake of the George Floyd murder and Breonna Taylor murders, both of those murders, and the student movement that ensued as a result. That is a very progressive student movement. It's an attack on students, because the students are calling for change, including at, like at the University of Texas, for support for the ethnic studies curriculum. I mean, they have a number of demands as a result of what they saw play out. One can get an education at the University of Texas and probably most universities throughout Texas and the United States without knowing anything about the U.S.-Mexico border or about indigenous peoples. It's really time to change that. And those in power want to tamp down on is exactly those voices and that scholarship, that knowledge, that precious knowledge that was the center of the lawsuit that had been filed in Arizona when Mexican American Studies was dismantled by the state superintendent of instruction, and that resulted in just this really litigious struggle and battle over the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And I am confident, I was an expert witness in that trial, and thankfully we won. And what prevailed was the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is very powerful in this country because it not only protects those of us in ethnic studies who are arguing for a right to our viewpoint, our studied viewpoint, right? But it also defends the right for their perspectives and viewpoints. So I really do think we're going to win this one, and there are going to be legal options. It might be a long haul, a long battle. I don't have any illusions here, but because of the power of the First Amendment that protects us all, right? I'm very hopeful. In October 18, 2010, was when Maya Arce, and she was a student in the Tucson Unified School District, filed a lawsuit along with other teachers against, against the Arizona Superintendent of Instruction. And that played out in the courts. What was very important in the process was once there had been a ruling at the district court that argued against the plaintiffs, and so the plaintiffs took it up to the Ninth Circuit. And what was important to the Ninth Circuit, and I think this is just just so vital, is in our understanding of this attack on critical race theory, is that the Ninth Circuit could not understand why the Tucson Unified School District and the State Superintendent of Public Instruction would close down a program that was successful, right? That it was actually contributing to the outcomes that we say we care about: higher student attendance, student achievement, higher graduation rates, higher college attainment, college going rates. And so that is really what is underneath all of this struggle. That is what is happening right now, is that we are getting recognized when we achieve, when we do well, and the culprit here is our precious knowledge.
So what you're saying is that there was evidence that was provided that students who were enrolled in the Mexican American studies were actually doing better and were actually being motivated and actually going to college more as a result of that than anything else that they were doing in school, so that there was an achievement success that was taking place, and that was shown and demonstrated in court, right?
Yes.
Interesting, because I think that if we continue sort of like along those lines, you have, as an author, you have penned a number of very good books that have provided a context for a lot of this, where you explain a lot of that, where you explain the issue of, authentic cariño, caramba, that we need to make schools, more humane rather than this cold thing that the Arizona superintendent wanted to do by just destroying a curriculum that was working, and ignoring the role that people of color have played historically in this country in shaping a better and more humane and más cariñoso curriculum, okay, that develops people. So subtract the schooling, you dwelt into those issues and going quote, critically conscious teachers, which I'm very aware about, with Christine Sleater and others. You again went into how we need to prepare teachers of consciousness, teachers that really have that. And your work in terms of authentic cariño, how do we make sure that Academia Cautli and everything else is part of this effort to transform how we teach, how we make sure that we prepare a generation for the future, so that when we go, we have people to follow. I mean, I have been dealing with this advocacy thing for more than 50 years. We still got a long way to go. Every day we find some kind of a hurdle or an obstacle and we deal with it. But you have put it in writing. And you have recently done the same thing with critical race theory. It's not necessarily a new thing. We were dealing with that in the 60s through the civil rights movement in the 70s. Now it's taking on, you know, new forms. It has evolved into something that we all embrace, because we are a significant group in American society as Latinos. And when we combine ourselves with African Americans, with Asians, with indigenous people, there's a lot of us. In many school districts, we are the majority, okay? So there is nothing wrong in transforming the curriculum to be able to do what you have so well described. Can you tell us a little bit more about your effort right now to get critical race theory clearly understood by communities, by scholars, by others, and what you hope to do with critical race theory?
Yes. So first of all, the attack on critical race theory is a misrepresentation, right? It's really a catch-all so that people can be, particularly at the school board level, where a lot of these battles are being fought out, can be empowered to absolutely reject anything that is critical pertaining to race, culture, sexuality. You can imagine how far this goes. It's a slippery slope once you start eliminating these critical knowledges, right? And so what is not understood is that it's really just but one of many approaches, primarily in the college classroom. It's not taught at the K-12 level. This is an academic approach that is really concerned about stubborn historical forms of oppression that just don't seem to go away, even with liberal kinds of policies that we've put in place. And so at the K-12 level, what you have is at most, at best, just this commitment to anti-racist pedagogies, right? We want to eliminate racism in its many forms. And so when those that are in power saying they want to get rid of critical race theory, really what they're saying is that they don't want us to know our history. They don't want us as people of color, as subaltern members of society, to have any access to any curriculum, including in Texas, anything under the banner of controversial topics that might actually be insightful for how we're to respond, how we're to organize, how we are to push back on policies that are directly hurtful toward us. And so having said that, I think in the misrepresentation and that again suggests that that's all we teach, right? And that we're teaching on the one hand victimization of Black and Brown people, and on the other hand we're teaching that, you know, white children are inherently racist. I mean, if any teacher is teaching that white children are inherently racist, they should not be in the classroom. And so, but that is what the bill says. It doesn't say white, but that you shouldn't teach that way, that no individual should be subjected to that form of teaching. But you can fill in the blank there, and we know that they're referring to white children. And so what again people aren't understanding is that in the ethnic studies classroom, the idea is to not stay focused on those racial inequalities, anything beyond trying to understand what is responsible for our trauma and our subordination in terms of the economy, in terms of the labor force, in terms of access to healthcare, and just the many indices where we are not given our opportunities, right, and even our rights, but to then go then to a place of authentic cariño, to authentic caring, to a place of a shared humanity, right? So the idea actually is the opposite of what those who are saying that CRT needs to go away. Right. They're saying that we're racist in teaching racism. That's what they're saying. Actually, that what we're saying is that is that we need to address issues of race, to address not only historical trauma, but then to get on the other side of that and to celebrate the rich diversity of our country and of the world, right? And we can do that at the same time and foster the healing that we need to have. And beyond that, a real ideological commitment that que tú eres mi otro yo, right? In Tucson, in the Tucson Unified School District, they taught in la Quech. Those are indigenous values, the Mayan concept of the golden rule, right? To do unto others, right? As you would have done to you, to love the other as yourself. Tú eres mi otro yo. I mean, how can I possibly love you if I don't love myself, right? And so love and caring is important because if I, you know, like see you in all your intersectional differences, and if I see you in a loving way, then I'm only enhanced and the world is enhanced. It's a better place.
Love it. Love it. Thank you, Angela. We could go on. and I'm getting the signal here in terms of our time. So I wanted to wrap it up just real briefly in terms of not only thanking you, but giving you the opportunity, Angela, once more, to wrap it up in terms of anything that we have left out, because I know Tony and I have 10,000 questions left.
A ton of questions for Angela, friendly questions, obviously, but so there's no time. Okay.
What is the takeaway today, as you see it, and for our audience?
Well, I just have a concluding thought, and I think the pandemic itself has given many of us pause, and it's making us realize that, you know, the most important thing right now, or perhaps, you know, always has been the most important thing, really isn't what many are focused on, which is students' test scores and higher achievement, or what's termed learning loss. I mean, all of this is very deficit sounding, and these are toxic discourses. And so, you know, what I hope is happening with the pandemic and the cosmic pause, frankly, that we're all in at this moment, is some humility that the world and the planet is a big place, that we are not in sync with Mother Earth. And as part of that, that we also have power as a community. We all pay taxes. We're paying for the public education that seeks to oppress us right now. And yet we act like clients so much of the time. And so we need to acquire and manifest a sense of ownership, right? And not to promote victimization or resentment toward anyone, but to work collectively, to be in right relation to each other and the natural world in order to heal our earth and society.
Love it. Thank you. That's powerful. Tony, any concluding thoughts?
No, I think that Angela has done an excellent job of presenting the issues here to us in this this medium. I appreciate very much what you have shared with us. Te instigo a que sigas hacia adelante. This is important for all of us. All of us have to continue to do that. So thank you so much, because I know that time is of the essence here, but we should continue in the future to have this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. The dialogue will continue with or without this podcast, but hopefully we have stimulated your thinking a little bit in terms of some of these issues, both broad and narrow and rather specific, but rather and critically important. And let me give everybody who's listening, who's viewing, an assignment. And that is that you have to read at least one of the books by Angela Valenzuela, but let me give you my favorite, which is Subtractive Education. It is a must read. If you're an educator, if you're interested in education, if you want to learn more about what's going on, that's a valuable book to read.
So, but they also have to read Critically Conscious Teachers. This is very important.
I know, I had to choose one. Be mindful, be aware, and be reading in terms of what some of these issues are. Thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure, Angela. Thank you, Tony.
Y saludo a la gente de Texas.
Yes.
Gracias, gracias. Que tengan buen día. Thank you so much. I'm very honored. Very honored. Thank you.
Gracias por todo.